You're listening to Fakeologist Radio, where we talk about the biggest hoax of our time, 9/11, and all the psyops and hoaxes before and after September 11th, 2001. You can call us at 518-564-0491 or Skype contact Fakeologist. We stream 24/7 at stream.fakeologist.com. Our archives are at radio.fakeologist.com. The show normally broadcasts at 9:11 p.m. Eastern Time, but we may live broadcast any evening time as guests become available. Now, here's your host, Avarado. Good evening, everybody.
Good evening, everybody.
It is Sunday, April 20th, 2014. It is Easter Sunday all around the world where Christians rejoice, get together, celebrate with family and friends. I believe about the return, the rising of the Holy Spirit. I'm not a religious person. I don't know much more past that. So I can't really help you much farther. This is sort of an impromptu broadcast. Every now and then I get the urge to talk. I did talk with family and friends today, and it was quite a deflating experience because, of course, there's nothing to talk about unless you want to talk about the big elephant in the room that has become my way of thinking. And inevitably, there's no conversation that you can have with any thinking people without crossing into the fakery side, since everyone's reality is based on the media, what's brought before them. The media is just a word that means middle, in between those that rule over us and those that are ruled. So their media is what we end up talking about, other than the weather, of course. There's no media normally. There should never be between the weather and oneself. So usually you can walk out and experience the weather, but you'd be amazed how many people won't walk out of their house without turning on the television to find out what the weather's doing. Instead of poking their head out a window or walking out the front door, they will turn on the media and get an interpretation of the weather. And half the time, it's very, very scary. I don't know about you, but it's amazing how they can turn a bunch of showers into 40 days and 40 nights of rain. It's almost biblical the way they exaggerate weather. So just go outside and bypass the media and find out for yourself. So tonight we're going to do a quick chat with Rick Potvin. He's a regular contributor to Fakeologist.com. He is the founder of a new type of thinking, hoaxology, which I suppose could be the evil twin, or the twin itself of fakeology, and just using the Yakin and Boaz metaphor of twins and two independent towers. I was driving around today and look around at some of the newer buildings, or even some of the older buildings. You'd be amazed how many of the big buildings, whether it be residential or commercial, are twinned. It's pretty fascinating. Maybe it's just an economies of scale. It's easier to build two than one, or cheaper, but it's amazing, all the twins. So, Rick, welcome to the broadcast, and you are the chief hoaxologist.
Thanks,
or fakeologist.
Thanks. I came up with the word hoaxology not as a really competitor to fakeology, but just as another word that's out there. That's kind of funny, and you kind of expanded on it, giving the origin as hocus pocus.
Mm-hmm.
I found fascinating. So it's a form of magic or a form of mind control, in a way.
Mm-hmm.
What's curious to me is that in my neighborhood here in Phoenix, where there's many Latino people, and I do shopping and interacting with Latinos all the time.
Yeah.
And discuss with them in a joking way some of the hoaxes going on in a friendly way, and use the word hoax. They're totally unfamiliar with the word, so I end up explaining the word hoax around the neighborhood.
Is there a Spanish equivalent of the word?
I don't think. I guess there isn't. I haven't asked, but the idea of the hoax is new to that culture, it seems to me. They may have their own concept. The whole idea of hocus pocus is interesting, the mm-hmm. background of that. So I found that enlightening that you posted that.
Yes,
and,
I think I got that.
The word has an X in it, as in SpaceX or the Exxon. X seems to be an interesting letter in the alphabet that tends to derive more attention. At least I found when I looked at the articles about marketing studies that Exxon took on when they were previously called Esso. They invented their new name called Exxon with the double X.
So yeah.
So the other letter X also has this connotation of X-rated in, adult movies, and there's also the triple X on the bottle of booze that you mm-hmm. see in cartoons all the time.
Well, X is a power letter, I think.
It was an interesting concept.
I think
I'm just playing with it.
Yeah, I think X is a power letter as well.
A power letter.
Yeah, I think so. It just there are ways to name companies, and there are certain combination of letters that emote power.
SpaceX actually is in the news this morning because the Dragon, which is the space capsule, mm-hmm. Apparently berthed or docked, I guess they say berthed now, with the space station at 9 o'clock this morning.
It had to be 9, didn't it? Was it 11 after 9, perhaps?
It was actually 8:56 a.m. I don't know what time slot that was, but so that's a fake event for Easter morning. Mm-hmm. In addition to the resurrection, which I started exploring too, which you can see at the top of my forum, which is network54.com/forum/153202,
yes.
I have a picture of the rising Jesus. Now, you noted in your introduction, you're not totally familiar with what Easter's about. You noted that it's the rising of the Holy Spirit. It's actually the resurrection of Jesus Christ.
Yeah, sorry, I got it wrong. I know
so
I get it wrong.
He rises up into the air, and I find the Renaissance paintings of the depiction of this event, which I didn't believe as a child growing up, which mm-hmm. was expected of me to believe, quite fascinating, especially given, Google picture search and the variety of pictures that you can find on Bing.com now, too. So we've got a virtual library of illustrations of the past 600 years or even the past 1,000 years. I don't know how long painting, Renaissance-type realistic painting, has been in existence, maybe 600 to 700 years. But these paintings are fabulous because they depict the event in a way that has been promoted in Catholic churches at least for 600 years or more. And floating up into the air after walking around for 40 days is the essence of the resurrection in the glorified body is what today represents.
Mm-hmm.
And when Jesus originally came out of his grave after being crucified, he walked the soil of the earth, visiting with the apostles and with his friends and associates in what appeared to be a normal body, but he was also noted to say things, as quoted in the biblical account, that he is not to be touched, which gives me the notion that maybe he was a plasma body or a holographic body of some sort from the fourth dimension. So the essence of the story, to me, has always involved science fiction and more lately ancient alien-type technology of interdimensional elements. So there's a definite language associated with the resurrection, such as the glorified body. And that is interesting because I think if we're going to talk about any of these events, like the missing plane or, the Jewish Community Center shooting or SpaceX, it always seems to me that the first step in looking at any of these hoaxes or these fake events is to determine what the narrative is that's being promoted. Often we don't even get that right to begin with. Do you find that?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
A lot of people will make comments or not understand what's going on or debate the issue without even understanding the official fake narrative.
And, that's
where I like to go. I like especially 9/11 is an example. We need to recount the official fake narrative first and then poke holes in it. And with the resurrection, most people don't even know what the official fake narrative is.
I agree. I don't even know. Yeah, I don't have a clue either.
Right. Well, Jesus descended into hell for 3 days after his crucifixion. Now, the ancient alien theory and the ancient theory that goes back to ancient mythology associates Jesus with the Egyptian Osiris. And a lot of writers and thinkers now believe that Jesus is a recreation in contemporary terms of the past 2,000 years with something even more ancient that goes back to maybe 3,000 BC to the ancient Egyptians, where we had Osiris and Isis as ancient gods, and that these gods were not necessarily completely mythological, but that they existed in reality as aliens, either interdimensional or extraterrestrial, and that they did have superpowers. And so after listening to a lot of Coast to Coast with Nuri over the years, and
I think that might be affecting you.
It certainly is. But, like I said before in my previous interviews with you, I've always been into science fiction. I love creative ideas. And along the way, if we can find reality along the way, to me that's a real great bonus. I really appreciated your discussion with Simon. It's great to have Simon back, by the way.
Always good to have Simon back. Simon always brings a lot of good information to the table, and this is a long weekend, and you are the third of a trident or triple header broadcast for Fakeologist Radio. We had Simon on yesterday, episode 99, and before that we had Jungle Surfer, who is one of the most prolific hoaxologists on YouTube. I would definitely take a look at his stuff. A lot of it's hard to follow and way out there, but he does know his history. I'm pretty sure of that.
I loved the Jungle Surfer's analysis of the Moore tornado. That's where I first discovered Jungle Surfer. His way of speaking and his articulation and the way that he expresses his surprise and his manner of mocking the still photos and the videos just is beyond normal humor. I mean, it's humor expanded to a new dimension.
And he has a lot of good stuff. He really does. His latest video is Waco, which we all know there. And here's his voice if you haven't heard of him.
Remember Waco.
This is the birth of Alex Jones, I think. Waco. And he's got quite a way.
So when I've seen
jungle of the exposing the hoaxes, the fake events. So he's pretty interesting. Yeah, I wanted to have you on tonight because I had a little talk with my parents about power, Ontario power, and they're stuck, of course, in the narrative going on about just all the fraud and how it's just a big incompetent government organization. And they asked me my opinion on what was happening with the power because I was telling them the prices are going through the roof in Ontario here, and there's there's no end in sight, quite frankly. And I said I can probably attribute that largely to the fact that there is no 65% nuclear power. And then, of course, I had explained 9/11 a little bit, and that became quite the unraveling, and conversation didn't end too well. So basically, I'm being labeled a social outcast. I'm already marked for that now at family gatherings, unfortunately. And it is a lonely road to hoe trying to propagate these ideas. And then I always try and circle back to 9/11 because that is the foundation of which I started the website. So really, it's the only thing I'm quite sure of that was fake or hoaxed or really misrepresented to us. So that's
getting into the Ontario power generation. In the last call we had, you wanted to talk about nuclear power with me, and we really didn't get around to it. But I grew up in Ontario, and my dad worked for Ontario Hydro at the time. It was a Crown corporation.
Mm-hmm.
Crown corporations in Canada are quasi-governmental organizations. They're semi-independent, but they're also considered to be monopolies of sorts because there's only one way to transfer power through rights of ways, and only one power station on physically can go on a river, and that dammed river, and a lot of Ontario's power comes from water generation.
Yes.
So I've seen a lot of plants, both in terms of the water generation plants and the insides of these plants, and I've been to a lot of what they call transformer stations.
Okay.
Which takes the source of the original kilowatts of power at the rating it is, and converts it to something usable in the home.
Yes.
And certainly this is all real. There's 230 kilovolt power lines that we see running up and down through the province are very real. The problem is I've never really considered which way the power goes.
Yes. And you can't see that.
I'm sorry?
And you cannot see that.
You can't see which way it goes. So, and a lot of people won't even, I've never really considered which way the power goes. One thing that I did come up with recently is I took a look using Google and Bing Picture Search, which are fantastic, of the various power generators in the Ontario power plants.
Okay.
Kind of reviving my memories of my visits with my dad to these power stations, where he did take us on tours of plants at Niagara Falls, for example, below the waterfalls and to Adam Beck Power Station, and old 25-cycle power plants that were built at the beginning of the century that were still running in 1972 when he was assigned to rebuild a power plant based on updating it to a 60-cycle plant. And so being familiar with those types of generator wheels, I became interested in a little bit about how these wheels operate, since they're such large, metallic, gargantuan spinning objects that reminded me of gyroscopes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as in all my posts on my blog, you can see that one topic leads to another. So I'm going to jump ship here just a little bit from power and move into what I consider to be a problem with the rotating Earth theory.
Okay.
And, you know, a lot of someone listening might think, well, you know, that's quite a leap. But I've been in search probably for about 6, 7, 8 months for online sources of powered gyroscopes. The powered gyroscope is an interesting device because a gyroscope, as any physics teacher and any kid who attended, you know, physics class in grade 10 or 11 will tell you, has a life of its own. You can experiment with that on your own by trying to spin a bicycle wheel and holding the axle in your hands and turning it. There's also toy gyroscopes. It's got a torque, it's got a force, and it tends to want to stay in its original position once it gets up to torque speed. And so if you consider the fact that missiles and rockets use gyroscopes, and that gyroscopes are considered to be kind of a military technology and to be licensed and controlled, a gyroscope becomes a really interesting element in the rotating Earth. If the Earth actually rotates, you can imagine that a gyroscope set up to speed at a certain point, let's start with on the equator of the Earth, would change position from, say, an original horizontal position, say, on the equator of the Earth, to a completely 90-degree vertical position. Once the Earth has turned, or spun, as we're told, it turns around and revolves around every 24 hours, so that in 6 hours it would move from a horizontal to a vertical position. Now, I've drawn pencil diagrams on sheets of paper. Any listener can do that themselves. And the problem here is that, let's go back to the power station. If we look at these electrical power generators, these huge iron behemoths that spin, the axis on those have to be of super strength, because as the Earth spins, those rotating objects must be able to maintain their position despite the force of the rotating Earth making them want to change position relative to the surface of the Earth. Am I making myself clear here?
Yeah, okay, yeah. So they would sort of conflict with the Earth as a gyroscope, right?
Exactly.
Okay, I get it. So they would be disabled in a way.
They would be disabled. Because if there's not enough force applied to the axle to hold that spinning generator in position, 6 hours later, as the Earth turns, this thing is going to want to flip off its axis.
Mm-hmm.
And you can imagine after day after day, week after week, year after year of the spinning generator being of wanting to flip off its axis at whatever RPM it's at, that eventually the force would get it and it would flip out of its axis. And in fact, if we look at going back to the nuclear power plant as a not as a power generator,
there's
but
a heat
as a
sink.
Power dissipator.
Yeah, dissipator, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That is faked as a power generator.
Mm-hmm.
I'll explain that briefly, is that we see the nuclear power plant now as a way to maintain the load on a power generation system. And nuclear power has never consisted of more than 15% of what they say is the power generation of any country on the planet right now.
But in Ontario, it's supposed to be 65%, believe it or not.
Is that what they say, 65%?
Yeah, 6 plus 5 is 11,
I have to look into that. Yeah, that's interesting. I would have thought that water power would have still outproduced nuclear power, along with gas and coal. But you're saying they're claiming 65 now.
Well, it's been that way for a while, and the whole point was that... Well, coal is gone out of Ontario, I think, completely. And gas is only coming online because if there's no such thing as nuclear, as I was debating today, then we have quite a bit of importing that we're doing, probably, but not declaring it, perhaps, because we're highly connected to the Northeast grid. So we're getting probably lots of power from the dirty coal producers of Michigan and Ohio, which are just across the lake. So stopping coal production in Ontario is like trying to eliminate the peeing section in a swimming pool. It doesn't make any sense. So gas is coming online specifically because we probably are missing lots of power because of no coal. And I don't think nuclear, of course, is in the equation at all. And it doesn't really have to be. And like we've sort of surmised or proposed that nuclear power is the plants are dump load facilities. Instead, they import it and they drain off any excess power that's not consumed at any one time.
Well, you're almost correct. Let me modify that just a little bit. The idea that it's a power that it's a heat dissipator, and that the associated terminology they're using is dump load is true. It's not excess power that it's dumping though. It's really, I suppose, in a way it is excess power, but in a way it's not, because what it's doing is maintaining a load on the system.
Yes.
And the reason you have to do that is because you can't shut generators down overnight and then start them up again in the morning as if you're on a cruise ship or something.
Right.
You have to keep those generators moving, and so if the generators are moving, they have to be generating power. And you have to put that power somewhere. And what our theory is that the power is generated back up to the nuclear power plant, say at Bruce or Darlington, and that the heat that's generated is blowing off these huge water towers or into the lakes to heat up the lakes, or to be blown off as steam off the water towers, which you can see in China. China's building a lot of nuclear power plants, they say. And if they are dump loads, it would make sense that they have to increase the number of steam dissipators, called nuclear power plants, in order to accommodate their increased number of real power-generating coal plants.
Yes.
Right.
Well, my theory is, my limited, I don't have a great theory of, I don't really understand electricity 100%, I'm not an electrical engineer, but I'm not going to appeal to authority in this case. My theory is that the grid has to be overcharged at all times. Because for it not to be overcharged at all times means that there would be brownouts if an unspecified or large number of people suddenly drew upon the system. So they always have to have that idea that the consumer end will always have to have that excess power in case everyone goes and plugs in their toaster at halftime. Now, when it comes to a industrial use, they do have to call the grid operator and announce their intended drawing down of the system, at which point they could ramp up certain production to meet that demand within a few seconds. Otherwise, it would cause a blackout. That's my theory. So I think you're right. If the grid is always overcharged 20%, then they have to dump that 20% if it doesn't get used. And it always has to be plus 20 or 25 or whatever the number is at all times. So if all the toasters do get on, it will draw down on that surplus. And then they would probably have to ramp up production however long it takes. And then
I think the term I heard when I was growing up was capacity.
Mm-hmm.
There's an electrical physics involved that involves the term capacity rather than overcharge, but it amounts to the same thing.
Okay. That's just my thought. So really,
sure.
That's just my idea, and I don't know. I could be totally wrong, but again, it all goes back for me. And my father was just telling me how I'm building a whole case on a completely wrong idea, a kernel of fallacy. And I said, well, I can see how you would think that, but then I will have to return to 9/11 and say, listen, my theory is based on the fact that if 99% of the planet was fooled by this particular event, more recent in fact, then why wouldn't it be possible that the whole planet could be fooled about another huge idea in the past?
Precisely the thinking, you know, that I had with respect to 9/11, only instead of regards to nuclear power, in regards to making a final conclusion about the fake moon landing.
Sure.
Once 9/11 occurred and I saw through it, then it occurred to me that what I had been considering with respect to the moon landing hoax is more likely to have been true, since if we could have been fooled by 9/11, then certainly we could have been fooled by the moon landing hoax. Right.
Yes.
So you're right. I mean, one hoax generates
begets another
vitality of intellectual curiosity to solve another, doesn't it? There's a cross referencing going on.
Now, am I wrong about nuclear because I'm not in the industry? I don't understand high level physics. Well, it's quite possible I could be completely wrong, and I'm not saying I am right. I have no way to prove it. But then again, a nuclear physicist couldn't prove to me I'm wrong anyway. There's nothing he could say, especially if he has no interest or no research into 9/11. So if he's completely fooled there, I don't see why he couldn't be completely fooled in another department just because he's got many more years of education and knows all the mumbo jumbo about the whole thing. Doesn't really make him any more advanced.
Personally, people involved in the nuclear power industry.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's like meeting a priest in the Roman Catholic Church or meeting one of my teachers from the past who today are on the internet and don't really pursue serious discussion. So your Easter meeting with your family, if you meet up with someone who is a professional with the iron ring or who has credentials or who has expertise, it's very difficult to get them to talk with you seriously because they're very adept for some reason at skirting things.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Of not answering questions. I had a family gathering with a guy who is working at a Bruce nuclear power station, and the most I got out of him was that Bruce was sold to a private British corporation, and it was no longer Ontario Hydro.
Yeah,
and
they want to take over the other plants.
Right, but then we moved on to his children's concert on his family movie tape on his big screen TV.
Interesting.
So, what are you going to do? And then the family came in and we had dinner and a polite conversation and talk of music. But how do you circle back around to getting in the details of what he does at the power plant? It's socially impolite, not possible.
That's right. That's why my experience today just reinforced how antisocial our talk is. We could not have this talk. We'd be considered antisocial. We'd be considered completely delusional. We're not enjoying life. And we just will not get the time of day. So if anyone wonders, well, why isn't, for instance, the 9/11 hoax being discussed or cracked open? Well, here's why. Those that create these hoaxes and know the psychological barriers that are all around permeating society.
Psychological barriers, right.
That is the main reason. Nobody is breaking this down. There's some news, which they control reports about it, but the coffee house, the family room conversations never get going.
Well, that makes psychology an actual physical event then, not just a cognitive, flexible, fuzzy thing, but an actual brick wall.
Yeah.
And so in terms of concepts and in terms of ideas, ideas and concepts can actually be considered to be physical elements that are as detrimental to communication as brick walls and lack of communication wires. If there's no willingness to talk and if the psychology isn't there, then you might as well, as the saying goes, be talking to a brick wall.
That's right.
Let me circle back around to the power plant for a minute here before I forget, because I want to go back to the generator.
Yeah.
Okay, and the gyroscope. The generator and the gyroscope. Okay, so if the nuclear power plant is a heat dissipator, which does nothing but heat up the Great Lakes, if they're on the shore, because you always find these things on the shores of bodies of water, which they say in Ontario they need the heavy water molecule, which is one molecule in a million, say, in order to run the power plant, but which in actual fact might be a place to put this heat dissipation unit to cool down the heaters that are thus run by...
Yeah, they call them nuclear rods. System. They call them nuclear rods, but they could actually be just some kind of rods that contain electrical coils to dissipate heat.
Yeah, they might. You know, now that you mention it, they might not even be electrical. They could just be heat dissipators, titanium rods that they gather heat efficiently and then stick them in the water and cool them off.
I mean, so actually, you're saying the rod goes around the wire, how exactly would that work? Would the actual high tension wire, high voltage electricity, just be within the rod, or how does that work?
You know, I'm not sure. Yeah. I think naturally, with a higher voltage in a wire, it naturally heats up.
Yes,
just
of course.
In your house wiring, I mean, the more voltage you pull, the more load you put on your house system through an appliance. If the wire is not thick enough, it's going to heat up.
Yes.
And so you take advantage of that relationship between electrons and heat, and you optimize it with a rod, what they call a fuel rod, which is maybe just a heat rod.
Yes. Yes.
And then
to dissipate
the heat in the rods, and then put them in the water.
Well, either way, it would work. Every bit of the engineering, would be equivalent. You see, that's where people don't get it. It's like, my father was saying how he knows somebody who worked on the cooling system in Pickering, and he developed some sort of super duper cooling system. But the point is, it doesn't matter. None of the engineering would change if the system was reversed. I'm thinking it would all be the same, because the rod would be still emanating heat because the electricity was coming into it. So instead of the rod generating heat from the nuclear reaction and creating steam, it could be the other way around. And because he wouldn't be able to see the direction, he could be completely fooled as well.
I'm sure a lot of them, must be fooled. And I was just thinking of Orwell as a doublethink.
Mm-hmm.
The engineers involved at the top rungs of this must be able to be capable of what's been termed in fiction doublethink.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be able to think in terms of one system for the public and in terms of the actual system for the insiders. Now, if you run the nuclear power plant as a heat dissipation unit, then you also have the possibility of using something other than heat dissipation in order to keep a load on the system is where my thinking led over the past 6 months or so.
Mm-hmm.
So I began thinking about the idea that instead of wasting this heat and sending it into the air through the what they're calling these cooling towers, out of which we see steam rising. And I guess people don't necessarily question the steam rising out of these cooling towers, which they should. But or if you don't question the heating up of the Great Lakes around the vicinity of the power plant, then you're not going to ask yourself the question I'm asking, which is, what is the alternative? If we're going to require power from gas, natural gas and coal and water plants, and we need to keep the power systems running, and we don't yet know how to harness the plasma of the ionosphere like apparently the ancient Egyptians might have with this ancient grid system on the Earth,
mm-hmm.
and then how can we keep these plants running and keep a load on the system in an honest way? So I started thinking of flywheels. Are you familiar with the concept of a flywheel?
Yeah.
Okay, well, a flywheel can get up to pretty good speeds, and they can store power, but just by mechanical spinning. And
using a spring system, or
I'm using what?
A spring system where they.
Well, I'm not sure mechanically how they're built, but basically what you're doing is you're converting one form of energy to another form of energy.
Mm-hmm.
If you keep a load on a system and you're generating, and you have to keep that electricity load on a system, then you can apply it to at nighttime, once the rest of the city's shut down for the night and your power load is lessened, you apply this power either to a pump to pump water back uphill, or
that's a good one.
Or you can use it. I mean, we need the irrigation of this country. Why I don't see why we don't pump the Columbia River back into the continent, or the Mississippi River back into the continent.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could use it to generate spin on a heavy-duty flywheel. And actually, I found a couple of flywheel companies that have been getting government contracts to build entire groups of flywheels. I think one of them is in Rochester, New York. And I took a look at a Google picture of this, and it's got like 20 flywheels, huge flywheels. The pictures don't look fake to me. They look real. The problem that they encountered was, guess what? The flywheels would fly out of their housing.
Mm-hmm.
And so they didn't really build them strong enough. Some of them worked fine, but it's an inconsistent technology. And I'm still not settled on where we are with flywheels. But it turned into a search for gyroscopes, because a flywheel is really nothing but a gyroscope.
Mm-hmm.
And a gyroscope has torque, and a gyroscope is necessarily going to have different forces applied to it as the Earth spins. And as the Earth rotates, we see the sun rising and setting from east to west, and there's been questions about the reality of that. And in regards to the flat Earth theory and so forth. So I don't know where we're going to end up with flywheels. If the Earth is indeed spinning, then flywheel technology is very tough to implement. If the Earth is flat, then flywheels should operate just nicely.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, if we go back now to the flywheels, which we call generators in the water power plants, that I visited and actually physically see, and you can view them on YouTube, it appears as though those flywheels work fine, that mm-hmm. they're not flying out of their housing, which would support the notion that the Earth is not turning after all. So
right.
I decided that I have to find a tabletop gyroscope. Follow me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's say you have a gyroscope on your tabletop in front of you at 6 p.m., just after dinner time, about the time it is right now in Phoenix. In 6 hours' time, by midnight, as the Earth spins a quarter turn, this flywheel should move from if we start at a horizontal position, to a vertical position. Now, I'll tell you where I'm at on that problem. I cannot find a powered gyroscope online to buy, to plug in,
mm-hmm.
that will run for 6 hours. They're all toy gyroscopes. Imagine that. All toy gyroscopes. I cannot find a powered gyroscope anywhere.
Interesting.
Now, I visited Ross the other day, they have a discount clothing store, and they have a lot of electrical appliances at the front of the store. And for the first time in my life, I considered getting one of those helicopters, remote control helicopters that I guess Radio Shack sells. And at Ross's, they have them on discount for $20 to $120, depending on the size of the helicopter.
Yeah.
Now, these helicopters, if you see the ads on infomercials for them, they're fantastic. They're highly maneuverable. You can fly them by remote control, and you can entertain your cats if you have any with them, and have a lot of fun with them. I looked at the fine print on the box, and of course they have gyroscopes in them, because otherwise you wouldn't be able to keep them stable and they wouldn't stay upright.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, wow, that's fascinating. I could use a remote control helicopter on some sort of rack and pinion device, maybe some universal hinge to enable me to see whether it can move in the relative to the surface of the Earth in 6 hours the way I would expect it if the Earth were turning. I'll tell you what the problem was. These things run for 10 minutes before the charge gives out. You can't run them for 6 hours.
Interesting.
Okay. Now, I also explored gyroscope companies online, because it's easy to do now. I don't have to run down to the library and the internet.
Did you post that on your network at all?
I did somewhere, yeah. I don't know where it is right now. But just a brief overview is that I did go to some of the online companies that deal in gyroscopes. I think probably about three or four of them. And explain my problem right up front, you know. Let them know what I'm trying to do, and it might have thrown a few of them off, but I got back responses that were indecisive and really didn't lead me anywhere.
Mm.
Nobody's willing to help. So at this point, I'm at a dead end.
Interesting.
I don't know whether that's a good end to this little soliloquy, but there it is.
Okay, we've got about 20 minutes left or so. Going to do a short, quick call tonight, so why don't we go through some of the hoaxologist.com site.
Okay.
Where did you want to start? Did you want to talk about what's the latest big thing that's going on? Did anything happen today, by the way? I haven't been looking. Today was a big day.
Well, the docking of the Dragon at SpaceX.
Okay, that's...
But the big thing in the news has been the missing plane, which is still continuing on CNN.
Do you get CNN?
Unfortunately, I pay for cable.
Okay. You know, so yeah. You can turn it on and see that it's there, that's going on, because I don't get
it. Right. Now, my theory on that is that the plane, of course, never existed.
Yeah.
So that's why they can't find it. And the idea that it's tied into some other plot appeals to me. I think there's some connection there.
Well, the big news it says here is the passenger.
Point out on your...
Well, I was just
Fort Hood situation.
Yeah, I'm not. I didn't really follow that at all. I was just looking at the top.
The crash entertained me. I don't know whether you covered that.
No, I haven't really talked about that. I'm looking at the headline now on CNN.com. Passengers on ferry were not able to move. So the South Korean passenger story is the big one on CNN right now.
Okay, Robert. The ferry just seemed like it was a little bit fake right from the get-go. The pictures that I saw on broadcast to mainstream TV were inconsistent. And the funny thing was that boat just capsized. Did you see that?
I really didn't follow that, so I can't really lend too much information on that.
Oh. Okay.
But I'm just discounting it as just about any other major promoted story. It's full of the numbers, and honestly, I didn't really look into it. I've been just not tuning into a lot of the major ones lately.
Okay. Go ahead. Did you have in mind?
Well, yeah, one of the posts on my blog was too many to count, which I think was talking about that was the ferry sinking. And at one point we had 900 people. A capacity of 900 people, but it was only carrying 470, include 330. So all the numbers were popping up in record numbers. So that was almost as much energy as I wanted to spend on that.
Sure.
So I really didn't delve into it, but I see you. I don't know if you've got a thread on your site on that particular one. I'm just looking at your site now. You've got lots on the space station shuttle that you posted, I guess, in the past month. I'm just looking at the interesting geometry of the threading on your site where it goes on quite an angle. I guess you've recently updated it based on the latest Dragon launching, I'm supposing, but I see you've got quite a bit of stuff on there.
Well, I found Hadfield interesting. David Bowie wrote a song called Space Oddity mm-hmm. in 1969. I played that video, and Chris Hadfield, the Canadian who says he's been on the space station, did the same song, mm-hmm. purportedly from the space station itself. So I tried to follow that out a little bit. Where okay. did Hadfield come from? And what is he gave a talk at one of the TED seminars.
Okay.
And that was entertaining to watch. And his description is of being on the space station, of blasting off in a rocket, is funny to listen to, given our perspective, because he describes the forces as he's sitting on the rocket, forcing him into the back of the seat. He's much more descriptive than a lot of the astronauts that we've seen out there. And
he's been very active, very active.
Spacecraft. And if you look at the Soyuz coming down that Chris Hadfield says he was in, watching the video, you see this Soyuz craft hitting the Earth in kind of a plunge, even though it's got a parachute. It hits the Earth so hard that it bumps up an entire cloud of dust. And you just wonder, how the heck can anybody survive that? And he doesn't really address that. He just assumes that we're supposed to assume that everybody survived the crash of that Soyuz spacecraft into the ground. Mm-hmm. So as far as a timely event, that's really interesting. I've seen the Chinese try to simulate landings of capsules on hard land rather than do landings in the water the way NASA Apollo craft did or Gemini craft. And they hit the Earth pretty hard. It's hard to believe that these guys come out alive after crashing into the Earth like that.
Interesting. I'm just looking on your site with this talk with Chris Hadfield. So he's going strong then with the propaganda.
Right.
Interesting.
What's the scariest thing you've ever done?
You know, for an astronaut and whatever the background we're told of this guy, he's certainly a very good at PR, which would sort of be the opposite of how you would take an introverted scientist, would you not?
Sure. I was amazed that he did that TED conference because he's a great speaker. And I've watched a lot of motivational speakers, and he's really on top of his game and speaking to his audience. And with his imagery and his descriptions, and it's actually well prepared. And taking a guitar onto the International Space Station is the height of audacity. Trying to sing a David Bowie tune from space is really funny. So I thought that was he's definitely an entertainer. I mean, as far as that goes.
Do you think he's one of those highly educated people in the Trivium, perhaps, who's been given some kind of high-level education that we don't know about?
Well,
is he that important?
What is the term that you used?
Well, I said that some of these people are educated in the Trivium and in some of the higher colleges. I don't know what his alleged background is, but one makes one wonder how important a role he plays to propagate the myth. He must be a good speaker. He must know how to deflect. He must know how to obfuscate, similar to the Clintons and the Obamas. He has a higher level because he cannot collapse under the pressure of the lie. And I think
he cannot collapse under the pressure of the lie. That's right.
And I think the original astronauts, they may have been pilots, Air Force people, and if they were not capable of dealing with the publicity and propagating the myth, they had to have been told to keep quiet and keep out of the limelight and only be pulled out on display when required. Whereas
yeah,
this Hadfield seems to be a different type of animal, where he engages. He is not afraid of engaging anyone at any time. And therefore, one might think he's got to have been better prepared based on learning the mistakes or the challenges they may have faced in the past with these other so-called astronauts. So just the fact that he's at TED and he's fully engaged with the media makes me highly suspicious that he isn't just a regular introverted type scientist type fighter pilot, whatever his military background may have been. That's all.
Right. There's a little flaw in his speech that I noted that's a tell.
Mm-hmm.
And,
okay.
Just as in poker, when somebody is not able to maintain a poker face,
mm-hmm.
Good players can tell the psychology, can notice the physical movements of another player in order to determine what the next play is going to be. The tell that this fellow has,
yeah,
is that he says things that refer to himself in a non-self-referential way. He constantly says you rather than I. In other words, he uses the term you can fly. He says you can see certain things rather than I saw certain things. He says...
So he's not speaking in the first person? He's speaking
in
the third person?
He's not speaking in the first person. He's speaking to the audience, telling them what you see. And he said, for example, he said, you can fly the Soyuz, a meteorite, he called it, to land within 15 kilometers of anywhere on Earth. He says, you can do that. Well,
mm-hmm.
what he means is, I can do it. But it occurred to me that this might be a tell, because maybe in his programming or whatever training he goes through, he's constantly being spoken to as with the term you. But he's failed to turn it around to
yeah.
adopt it fully into his own persona, to adopt it fully as an I.
Yeah, I understand. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's
yeah.
good.
So I thought that was, if I was to tell a tale of how I flew on a rocket and how I landed in the Soyuz spacecraft.
You'd be speaking in the first person.
I would speak in the first person.
That's very good. That's a good one.
Good
observation.
The fascinating thing about Hadfield is he claims in this video that I looked at that he, on his first spacewalk, went blind.
Hmm.
Isn't that bizarre?
Is that because of the sun, reflection and all that?
No, he didn't really explain it. He went on a long kind of little narrative about how the vision in one eye on his spacewalk started to disappear. But rather than deal with the vision problem in his speech, he discussed the idea of panic. And he relayed a 10-minute side story about how he and his fellow astronauts had been trained to respond to dangerous situations. That was the whole context of his speech. And that eventually he lost sight in both eyes on his first spacewalk.
So it seems like the purpose of these astronauts is to just to teach life lessons. They always translate...
It was a life lesson in how to not panic when something goes badly wrong, like losing your sight.
Yeah, but they're always translating their space experience, and I suppose it's because the plausible deniability is, well, the audience will never go to space, so let's make a life lesson out of what I experienced, because they will be able to relate to that.
That's right. It's kind of a soft story rather than a hard tech story, isn't it? He's not really describing any technological content.
Yes, that's right.
He's not using numbers and machinery parts and developing a technical explanation, something that you and I might appreciate. He's delving into the emotions.
Yes, he's selling space as a religion.
That's interesting, right?
I think. They're the new magi, they're the new high priests, and space just still represents reaching for the stars, imagination. It has nothing to do with the nuts and bolts of firing human beings past the Earth's atmosphere. It's just, it's really just a mythos that they're trying to promote. And it's all good feeling, all do your best. You can do whatever you want. You can be an astronaut yeah. one day. It's really hilarious. Just, it's really just Anthony Robbins.
Exactly.
Of NASA. Really, it is. And I don't really have a problem with an Anthony Robbins. It makes you feel good. But it's one of those things, I've never been to a seminar, but after you watch it, or after you've been to some of these seminars, even salespeople know after a sales meeting, you walk out of this rah, rah, rah session and you're back in the cold, harsh reality of Earth where every other word is no, no thank you. And it's very debilitating, and it's sort of like fakeology. We come here, we supercharge our batteries because we're all onto it. And then we go out in the real world, and we're just shot down like so many bad pilots, really.
I would debate you on that. I don't get shot down like that. I spin my delivery of these hoaxes in a very moderate way, not exposing myself to any of the necessarily negative feedback. So,
okay, well, you've got to train me.
All of my work is self-rewarding. I mean, if I can understand it, that's my first level of contribution, is if I can pull myself up by my own bootstraps and look at this material, you know, and I can walk confidently forward and not even tell anybody about it and still know that I've have kind of an edge on understanding what's going on. For example, let me move on to the Canada Space Arm.
Okay.
You're right down the road from Mississauga.
Right.
So yes. The Canadarm is Canada's contribution to the space technology.
Yeah.
And I actually grew up in high school with a fellow who ended up being employed by Spar Aerospace in Mississauga.
Yeah.
I had met up with him about 5 or 10 years later, and this was years ago. And he, I was very impressed. I mean, he was always into math and science, and I'm thinking to myself, gosh darn it, if I had passed all my science courses, I could be working in aerospace.
You
know? Yeah. So I looked up SPAR today, and their website is gone.
Wow.
And, I guess they got taken over by another agency through some kind of interaction with the Canadian Space Agency and NASA and Goddard, and I've got a lot of different elements there, but they ended up in Alberta. And I took a Google Street View map of their location, and they say their address now is on McTavish Road in Calgary, rather, yeah, in Alberta. And there's a plant that looks like a steel mill that there, and it doesn't look very scientific to me. It looks like some kind of production mill, so that doesn't look straight to me. I can't imagine a space arm being constructed there.
Interesting.
It seems like the entire space arm has been abandoned. But in the process, I learned about the Canada Space Agency as the internet, one thing leads to another.
Yeah.
And I started looking at Canada's first satellite called the Alouette. Yeah.
Okay.
Do you have any memory of that?
That's a song.
Yeah, it is. So I looked up Alouette, the song, and it goes like this.
Alouette, gentille Alouette.
That's a song from the 1950s. So I think they might have named the satellite after that and had a good time with that.
Yeah.
And I found out that the Canadian Space Agency and the Canadarm are tied very closely to NASA's Goddard Space Center. And that looked up the history of Goddard Space Center and ended up on naval reactors. Started circling back around to the nuclear power
submarines.
Idea on the submarines.
Yeah.
So going around in circles, Ab, on all the hoaxes, and one more thing is that the collapse of the ferry or the sinking of the ferry or the capsizing of the ferry. I wanted just to finish that off.
Okay.
The essence of that ferry is it looks to me like a drill. Because apparently one of my discoveries was that the 31st, what they call the 31st Marine Expeditionary Unit of the United States military, has been called into service on that case. And
You
look at the number of boats and aircraft carriers and military aircraft and helicopters and everything else associated, there's like three huge ships and 10 aircraft and numerous tanks and AVs and Hummers and everything associated with this 31st MEU, they call it. And it's being deployed to the site of the overturned ferry.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's the connection there? Well, it turns out that they've been asked to help in the rescue, but that also South Korea and the U.S. military have been running exercises and drills.
Yes.
In conjunction with North Korean drills. So I think there's a military component here that the capsized ferry is really an excuse to deploy military operations as part of an ongoing drill.
Well, you know, listen, I just drove by the firehouse where the fireman was standing in front of the fire truck, and I thought, how many fires really are there, for instance? And every time they want to cut the fire budget, they simply, they all rally together and say, listen, our response time would be cut from 5 to 10 minutes. And really, then I thought, well, that's why else does the fire department respond to every traffic incident? Well, if they didn't, they would hardly get to start their engines. So I think there's something similar going on with the military in the sense that we're not at war with anyone. Of course, they say it's the defense, not the offense. But these drills are really intrinsic to keeping the myth of the military alive and keeping the massive funding going. And they can simply point to, well, look how useful that was to have this great big military because we can react around the world to any event and save the day. And it just so happens they're doing a drill in the same area as per usual, as the plausible deniability excuse. And lo and behold, they probably saved more people than could have been saved had they not been there. So I think it really is just a self-justification thing in so many ways, just to keep the money train chugging down the tracks.
Well, yeah, I mean, that might be true. There might be an honest way to do it rather than a dishonest way to do it, however.
Well, I think they know that the public is so conditioned to having to respond to these dramatic events to keep the funding up that they're so far past being honest about things, then they have to continue to be dishonest. And I think it goes to even rebuilding a bridge on an interstate. They may just have to get their share of the dough to get it rebuilt. They may just have to stage a collapse and just make it into a big story, and that will secure the funding. I think it's now just ingrained in budgetary requests.
It's astonishing, isn't it, when you consider the fact that the scripts have to be written, that the different scenarios have to be written out, or that there's planners involved in creating the storylines that they have to write, or that they might be creating the storylines as we go along, or that there's so many participants in cooperating with the storyline, or that there's no investigative reporters who check into the stories and do the fact-checking like we're trying to do on some of the stories.
That's right. If there ever was an investigative report, but I think of it like this. Say there's a guy who wants to build a bridge or create a project or do something in an area. He might think, I'm never going to convince the people around my district or my area to go through with this. Who can I call to make this happen in my lifetime so I can get reelected, so I can get a bridge named after myself, so I can get something big for my area so people can remember my name? Because in the end, what else are politicians or governors or leaders going to do? So is it possible, and this is more thinking out of the box, which is required, which is we're so far out of the box according to social norms, if we may as well do it. So what if they could call some department in the military to say, hey, here's what I would like to accomplish. How can we make this happen? And they go to work on it. Okay, this is what we could do. We could do this scenario. This bridge collapses because this Canadian truck ran down the road, and even though he had all the necessary permits, he still somehow got on the wrong road, even though it's a bloody interstate, and it clipped the bridge and knocked it into the river. And lo and behold, we have a new infrastructure budget to redo all the bridges on this interstate in this state. How about that? And we'll create some drama. We'll create some falling into the river. We'll incorporate all that. We'll tug on people's heartstrings. We'll have a hero. We'll have all the elements of a really good story. And then just maybe we'll be able to convince all those spendthrift governors or spendthrift politicians to go along with it. Because darn it, we've got the video. We got the imagery. We got the public on our side. Let's just ram it through while everything is going real good.
You might have their way of thinking down pretty good. The question in my mind, though, is don't we have a lot of true needs and true requirements for civilization to exist? How haven't we been able to express and win political competitions based on real physical parameters? Is it really necessary to run the number of fake events that we see in order to compete? And more philosophically, I guess I'll wind up with this question. In the very end, I mean, since this is Easter, even though there's a mythical origin and a connection possibly to ancient aliens and Osiris and so on, the idea that truth is of value seems to me to be worth holding up here.
Well, that's what we're trying to do.
Why is the is the competition between truth and lie being lost to lie?
Well, it seems to be.
It could be, but how do you turn it around? I guess you just keep on going and do what we're doing. And I think Clues and at your forum and some of the videos, true videos online. Mm-hmm. Are having their effect, don't you think?
I think a microscopic effect. I'd like to think it's bigger. I was looking at some of the numbers today, and Simon was mentioning, of course, the episode 99, that he had a record number of viewers during last year's Boston Marathon bombing hoax event. So I often wondered how many people that come to his site for that highly promoted event spill over into his other areas and investigate some of the other hoaxes and get turned on to the whole concept of fakery and hoaxing. So I think as people get access to the internet and actually use it the way it's supposed to be used, and if they're not kept away by the skewed searches of Google, and we can only use Google as a substitute for the word search because they've dominated and captured the market, okay, which I think is unhealthy as all get out. And I try and use things like Startpage and other websites for searching, but it's hard to get away from what we're told is the most comprehensive and complete searches. So if people are able to break through the barriers and get to our sites and just open their minds to the concept of crazy thinking, which I was told, just crazy, right, out-of-the-box, nutty thinking, right, then just maybe there is a hope. So I'm not sure if we're going to peak in people's exploration of our sites. I'm not sure if there's going to be any kind of upcoming trend, for instance, in computing, how people are moving away from desktop notebooks into tablets, and if there's going to be a way to control these devices in a more efficient way to guide people away from real websites like ours. I don't know. I can't predict the future. I wish I could. So, yeah, I think it's still worth it for us. It's therapeutic for me to do my site, and I think it's therapeutic for you to put your notes down and all your thoughts and see if maybe others will coincide with your way of thinking by putting it in words. So it's good for us.
I like exploring the issues, and I learn things along the way. It's a great way to learn about different areas that I might not have looked into otherwise, such as the gyroscope.
Yeah.
And the rotating Earth. I mean, that to prove that the Earth rotates using a powered gyroscope is still something that I'm interested in doing. And I don't know if I'm going to have to build my own powered gyroscope in my spare time or not, or whether I can find one online. But that's what gets me up in the morning. Thinking, today, maybe I'll find a powered gyroscope.
Just to make sure you're on the right track, do you think it would be worthwhile to contact, say, a local university and see if there's a youngster there who could work with you and perhaps explore with you and maybe bring some of his so-called science into the equation, just to make sure that there isn't one simple statement that could completely discount your whole theory?
Oh, I don't think there's a statement that can discount the theory. I'm more advanced than maybe an undergraduate in terms of that, and I think undergrads at the universities are all tied up with their course material.
Okay.
And the graduates have already been have already figured out how to filter out the public knocking on their door.
Okay, that's interesting.
I used to call professors at universities after I left university in my years, mm-hmm. and they were quite open to various discussion just on long-distance telephone calls around the world. But the times have changed, I think.
Is that right?
It's more difficult to access people. Occasionally, I'll talk to experts personally by email. That's my favorite way to communicate now. But the kinds of answers I get from experts at the universities or the companies that I email are indecisive. They're kind of the type of answer that leave you hanging rather than are definitive and give you traction. It's not as if they're anxious to interact with somebody from the public like myself.
That is interesting.
Well, I mean, when you look at the university system, I mean, haven't they been a complete failure in terms of their understanding of the truth about nuclear power itself? And
well, they haven't helped in any way.
And the moon landing. I mean, the fact that they all cooperate and go along every day with the major hoaxes that we're pointing to indicts them on charges of complete dishonesty, of complete anti-intellectualism, of complete fakery on their part. And this is a multi-billion dollar, multi-decade industry, the university system. What are we dealing with here? It's astonishing. And so at the end of it, I think we can only value our own cognition, our own awareness and our own consciousness, interact as best we can with people around us, like I'm interacting with you or I do in the neighborhood as I go about my business. And the discussion forum that I run involves maybe a couple of people who kind of attack me once in a while. But most of the entries are by me, and I follow you and Simon, and I'm just happy to be able to understand the nature of the issues that we're dealing with. And that's a lot of fun for me.
Yeah, well, I'm enjoying it, and I like checking on your site, and I enjoy even your critical comments. I have no problem with that. So,
one more guy I want to mention that I hunted down to ask was Brooks Agnew. He's a hollow earther on Coast to Coast, who's been a guest on the reef from time to time. I followed up on his Twitter account.
Okay.
And I followed him and made friends with him. And Brooks set up a tour of a massive effort to go to the hole at the North Pole, because his theory is, of course, that the Earth is hollow, that the curvature increases as you approach the North Pole, and that old stories from the 1700s and 1800s, and even stories going back to the ancient Norsemen, where the Vikings disappeared after exploring a kind of a region around Greenland, and have thought to have been disappeared into the hole at the pole, makes his adventures something that he likes to sell. And so he was able to put together an entire, a voyage that he charged people money for setting this thing up. And then I followed it very carefully. And about a year ago, it just disappeared. He said they had a problem with their organization, and they just gave up. And so I emailed him, I tweeted him, and he had a consistent story that was kind of not fully explanatory. And I tried to follow up with my idea that if you just, instead of arranging a trip to go into the hollow earth, that if you merely went down the curvature into the hole toward the hollow earth and watched a gyroscope as you move into that hole kind of angle itself with respect to the surface of the earth more quickly than it would if the earth were not going into a hole, that you could therefore write a paper on that curvature mm-hmm. based on that powered gyroscope. And ships and planes have gyroscopes. We could do this so easily today just by signing up with a cruise ship that goes takes people on a tour to the North Pole. Well, he kind of stopped answering my tweets and stopped answering my emails without fully engaging. And I was really disappointed because I thought he was a real good advocate of the Hollow Earth and wanted to explore that. But that ended up going nowhere. I've contacted organizations that take people on tours to the North Pole. And I've asked them about their latitudes and longitudes, and they have answers that don't deal with the actual positioning of their ship. And I'm wondering, how can that be? How can you not know exactly where your ship is going to go on the tour? And I'm beginning to think that these tours to the North Pole don't go to the North Pole.
Yeah.
Because in, with respect to the Hollow Earth theory, if you take a look at all the literature on the Hollow Earth on the Internet, you'll see that the actual physical geographic North Pole has to be well inside the curvature that curves around into the Hollow Earth. So these trips that they're saying take people to North Pole, if the Earth is hollow, can't be going to the North Pole. There's a lot of really interesting information. Now, I'm not saying that the Earth is hollow. I'm not saying I believe the Earth is necessarily one way or the other, just like Simon has that alternative solar system theory that he's worked out.
Yeah.
All I'm doing is I'm working out a hypothesis. If this, then that. If yeah. the Earth is hollow, then that must be true. So you work out the hypothesis and you propose an experiment, just like we were told in high school.
Yeah. So do you listen to a lot of Coast to Coast? Because that concerns
Whenever
me.
Whenever I can.
Yeah, it just concerns me because I think they have a lot of disinfo on there, so it might be difficult to sift through.
Well, the beauty of it is that they publish all the links on their website, so you can pick and choose one item out of maybe 50 that they do and go and follow up on it. And the Hollow Earth with Brooks Agnew was one fascinating thing to me. Because if you think like a physicist and you think in terms of an academic, how do you prove that the Earth does spin? How do you determine whether there's a hole at the pole? You know, these are questions of concept that you introduced, and that you said you were fascinated by the concept of epistemology somewhere mm-hmm. along the way
yeah.
in your blog. Well, you know, the idea of epistemology of how do we know things goes back to ancient Greek times.
Yeah.
Even the ancient Greeks were youngsters, they were told, by some of the philosophers of the day, and that you really have origins of humanity going back to ancient Babylon. And then we see ancient megaliths around the world, like the Egyptian pyramids, but megaliths in many countries around the world, like Baalbek in Lebanon and some of the Peruvian sites. If we look at the actual physical structure of the megalithic structures that we cannot build today and we cannot explain, then what are we to do with history?
Mm-hmm.
I just, you know, it history is an open-ended question. Humanity is an open-ended question. It's all open-ended. So when we are accused of thinking out of the box, or if those who critique us want to say, well, we're crazy, I mean, that's fine with me.
Yeah.
Because there are no solid answers here.
No, that's for sure.
The only solid answer I can get, even the price of gasoline changed dramatically in Phoenix this past week. I was getting gas for like $2.95. All of a sudden, it's $3.45.
Yeah, it's off the charts. It's crazy.
So, you know, all I try to do is navigate and adapt to the world. And in the microcosm of my personal life, you try to tap dance your way and keep the pie plate spinning. And spend some time with the bigger issues, but the bigger issues are no more solvable than the microcosmic issues. But it's certainly interesting. So
quickly, I noticed you had a big section on the Kansas Jewish Community Center shooting. Did you want to have a quick comment on that? Are you pretty convinced that's a hoax and the whole racism, anti-Semitism? Shootings and events could be agitations by paid operatives?
You know, that's got a whole component to it that, I just don't want to deal with. I looked at it extensively, though, on my forum. What I'm doing is I'm just taking cues from No Disinfo, Mm-hmm. And they follow up on this with very radical analysis. But the nice thing about NoDisinfo.com is that they have an excellent photographic critique, just like Simon Schack's photographic critique of 9/11.
Okay.
If you look at the photographs that this guy puts together on NoDisinfo.com with regard to not only that event, but many other events, he's got an eye just like Simon does. I mean, he may not be analyzing it in a political or social or politically correct context, according to what people want to see, but the photographs...
Everything is Zionism on that site, right?
Yeah,
everything.
You know, but you can take or leave that part.
Yeah, that's true.
If you look at the photographs, I mean, he does a quick analysis. He does the analysis of the Boston bombing the same way we do. And mm-hmm. he picks out photographs, and I don't know where he gets them. I guess online like everybody else, but he spends a lot of time putting these together and critiquing them. So I just followed that because it's just one thing that happened in the past week that looks phony to me, you know. I like the Martian anomalies. I like I like space. I like the ancient aliens. I like the idea of the fakery, the resurrection. it's just endless, isn't it?
Yeah, it never ends, and it keeps us spinning and busy.
Spinning, yeah. Back to the gyroscope. I really want to get a gyroscope, and I'll let you know when I do.
Let us know how that works. Well,
it's got to be a power gyroscope. If you just sit there and watch it for 6 hours as it's running, it should move from a horizontal to a vertical position if the Earth is actually rotating, right? And if it doesn't, then, you know, we might not be on a rotating Earth, you know? So
okay.
I think that's, if we could find a silver bullet like that just to prove one thing, then that would make my day.
That's a big one, though. That's really confronting a lot of ancient and really, really old, well-established views that the Earth is round and spinning every 24 hours, a complete rotation, and it's going around the sun. That's when people really start to toss everything we have to say off to the side. But
well, that's a really big one, but it's so easy conceptually to prove. And guess, you know, the mm-hmm. amount of money that's invested in pendulums to demonstrate the rotating Earth is astounding. There's pendulums hanging from museums all over the world. Mm-hmm. Huge pendulums that apparently when you watch the periodic movement of the pendulum, they say at different latitudes on the Earth proves that the Earth rotates. Now, I'm not going to try to describe it in words on the radio here, but because you need diagrams. But to me, I've examined the pendulum theory. And even if you look at the history of the pendulum theory, it's not really definitive proof that the Earth rotates. There's some tricky problems in there. And
they explain them away?
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry?
And they explain them away?
They explain them away, yeah. Now, the actual proof to me would be in terms of the gyroscope. And Brooks Agnew, who was my primary guy on that, who's got a lot of publicity with all of Nuri's listeners and who I was able to tweet, stopped talking to me after I pursued this issue. And so I'm kind of disappointed. But the concept of a gyroscope in a physics lab in universities is so easy. It's just that there's no powered gyroscope that I can get my hands on.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll have to build one. But if we can prove one way or the other that the Earth turns or it doesn't, then I think we can go a long way to giving ourselves some credibility as analysts of reality and hoaxes and fake events.
Mm-hmm.
I think if we do the work ourselves, you know, as investigative journalists with the photographs and the physics and everything else, I think we can actually upgrade mankind's thinking.
Wouldn't that be something?
I have to think that way.
It's very positive. Well, thank you very much, Rick. We've gone a little longer than you wanted to, but I appreciate all the time and keep working on the website and keep commenting and keep thinking, really.
Okay, well, thanks for the call. It's a lot of fun talking to you.
Yeah, I enjoy it.
It's even more fun listening to you and Simon. It's a real entertaining show you guys put on.
Well, great, and I appreciate it. That's what it's all about, too, getting a little fun out of this crazy way of thinking that really goes against everyone's epistemology, I guess, the way of looking at the world. All right.
Talk to you next
time. Take care. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Now they're planning the crime of the century. Well, what will it be? Read all about their schemes and adventuring.
Thank you for listening to Fakeologist Radio. We do this show most Saturday nights. We stream our show 24/7 at stream.fakeologist.com. Contact us at contact.fakeologist.com. Our archives are at radio.fakeologist.com. Our backup site is fakeologist.wordpress.com. We're dedicated to exploring the world of media fakery. Since you're aware, point others to our website and let them discover a reality that they probably never knew existed.
But that's not right. Oh no, what's the story? Look, there's you and there's me.